I wish I had a gavel. I don't. Good morning, everyone. It's Friday the 13th of October, the best month to have Friday the 13th. I'm Senator Lincoln Fillmore. This is the Commission on Housing Affordability. We are a subcommittee of the Utah Unified Economic Opportunity Commission. It's 9:35, I think, and we are set to have our final meeting of 2023. We've got a couple of exciting items on our agenda. Since we don't have a quorum yet, when we do, though, we'll come back and approve minutes, and we'll approve them in the proper way, unlike what we've done prior, so that we can have those approved formally and correctly. We had some public comments that were emailed in that is in everyone's packet here today. I encourage you to look at those public comments. Is there anybody in the audience here today that wishes to address the commission before we get started on our agenda? Okay, Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the Commission on Housing Affordability. Cameron Dill with the Utah League of Cities and Towns. As part of your materials today, we've circulated a handout that is entitled the 2023 Housing Survey Preliminary Draft Report, dated October 10, 2023. And with the permission of the Chair, I'd like to take just a couple moments to explain to you the data collection that we've been undertaking this summer, and then take questions that any of you may have from it. What you'll see here is a survey that the League has done, so it's an internal survey, admittedly, but where we have heard back from all of our cities of the first class, so cities above 100,000, 71% of our cities of the second class, which are cities between 65,000 and 100,000, 76% of our cities of the third class, which is cities of 30,000 to 65,000, and then about half of the cities of the fourth class, which are cities above 10,000. And we're still actively gathering this data, which is why it's stamped at the preliminary draft at the top. So all told, we've heard back from over 60 cities and towns across the state, and we've surveyed them on a variety of topics ranging from how many units that those cities currently have entitled that are in the development process at some form or fashion, how those cities are working to help first-time home buyers, how the cities are planning for smaller lots, the city processes, and how cities are working on their general plans, which also include efforts around mixed use. So here, just quick high-level takeaways from the survey results thus far. The 65 cities that have reported back to us reported a total of over 165,000 units that are currently entitled, which means they are in some form of the development process. This does not mean that 165,000 units are ready to be built tomorrow, but it does mean that cities, as part of their efforts to plan for housing, have entitled and provided the zoning assurances for over 165,000 units. And you can see the cities, a sampling of those cities from the Southwest Salt Lake County, Northern Utah County on the left of what those communities are. Now, why are they entitled and not yet at the building permit stage? The top data point is the building permits that comes from the Kempsey Gardner database. The good news is even on the permit side, Utah has been a national leader in permitting new housing over the last few years. The entitled number is not yet at the permit number, and that's because of everything from private financing to market forces to infrastructure challenges to other things. Let me give you a few quick examples on the infrastructure front of burden of obstacles that both the private sector and local governments are facing. So in the community of Riverdale, for example, they've entitled 900 units in a mixed-use housing project, but the developer and the city need about $3 million to build a bridge that will make access to that project available. So that's 900 units that are waiting to find a funding stream to cover the cost of that bridge. In the city of Ephraim, they have over 1,000 entitled lots that are available to be built, but for the lack of water, sewer, and road infrastructure. In the city of Springville, they have a project that's entitled with over 1,800 housing units. It's in a greenfield area that has no water, no sewer, no stormwater, no roads, no sidewalks, or other utility infrastructure needs to connect into the larger city infrastructure system. And those housing units, 1,800 lots, range from 7 units to the acre to 22 units to the acre. So it's a nice variety of housing, but it's stuck until they can figure out a way to finance the infrastructure. Another example, in West Jordan, this is actually a success story, a partnership between the state and local governments. But West Jordan had 2,500 entitled housing units that were stuck because of the need for a 3 million gallon water storage tank and 20,000 linear feet of sewer pipe. The city put the overall cost was $17.5 million. The city covered about 85% of that. And then last legislative session, or two sessions ago, excuse me, the legislature filled the rest of that gap, and that unlocked the 2,500 housing units. Now, I use that term intentionally of unlocked because those housing units are not yet being built because of market forces. There's not a lot of appetite right now because of interest rates and other market forces that are outside of the city's control, but they are underway building that infrastructure that will unlock those 2,500 housing units, which include a variety of housing types. So that's the first key takeaway from our internal data, recognizing it's still in its preliminary stages, and we've got data from individual cities if you would like to know more there. Second key takeaway from what we're seeing is that the recent bills that this commission has endorsed and the legislature has passed are being implemented. Cities are implementing the strategies from moderate income housing plans, for example, and often that has resulted in reducing of lot size. You'll see on the back page that Utah has the 15th smallest median residential lot size in the country. And of our survey respondents, 73% of them have said they've reduced minimum lot sizes in some or all zones. And a lot of them do this actually through development agreements. And they do that for lot sizes or changes to parking minimums or setbacks based on those localized conditions. So our surveys also demonstrate some mixed results, that sometimes small lots result in smaller houses, sometimes small lots are resulting in larger houses that are filling the lots, but not actually affordable. So one quick example of where we've seen a good success story here, where city has, through the implementation of moderate income housing plans, Washington Terrace put together an infill ordinance, which has been targeting smaller lots, duplexes, and twin homes in infill areas within single-family zones, and they've been successful and have approved 3 different projects in recent months, and actually had support from neighbors for those smaller-scale infill projects as part of their implementation of moderate income housing plans. Then the third key takeaway from the survey results as far as the process and general plan piece, we're pleased to report that cities are meeting the state deadlines that were imposed by recent legislation around plan review. We are seeing that cities are, they've seen a major decline in their development fee revenue, and so particularly for the high growth cities, they're using other general fund revenues to offset some of those costs. And then cities are updating their general plans with regularity and frequency. And one thing we frequently hear is we need to make general plans more meaningful. And I would argue that we have over the last few years with bills that this body has endorsed, whether it's station area plans being part of moderate income housing plans, which are now part of general plans, water conservation elements, those different pieces have magnified the importance of general plans. General plans are the visionary, aspirational guiding document for the community, and then zoning is the companion. Combined, that sets the policy for the community. They're both legislative acts, and they're both important, and they work together to set the policy for the city. One interesting example is the community of Hyde Park. They reported back to us as part of the survey that they, in part because of recent legislation, updated their general plan. It was an over a year-long process with a lot of resident input. They doubled their base residential density in the city, and they, for the first time, created a mixed-use zone. They created zones in the city for townhomes. Unfortunately, they also reported that the market is dead right now. So they have laid the foundation with this new planning, but they're not seeing any sort of market activity right now because of the economic conditions. But they're taking the general plan requirements seriously. And I think this demonstrates that the bills that we've passed over the last few years are taking hold, and they are taking effect. The last thing I'll note, coming back to that first piece on the entitled lots and the infrastructure, is that the centerpiece of last year's bill on subdivisions is currently being implemented. The effective date of that, of the subdivisions part of that bill, goes into effect in February for our MIHP cities. At that point, cities will have a maximum number of red line back and forth that they have with developers, maximum of four, and they'll have the two-step process, preliminary and final, with no public hearing on that, that final piece. And we think long-term that's going to make a huge difference in how we administer subdivisions. Again, that's currently being implemented. So as you continue your discussion today about what items to move forward this year, I think this, the survey results demonstrate there's a lot of good work happening at City Hall as we work to implement what has been passed in recent years.
Thank you, Cameron. I appreciate that. I want to go back to your presentation, the section of your presentation on entitled units.
Uh-huh.
So I represent half of those cities that are listed there. And, you know, they know I'm the chair of this commission, and anytime I bring up this issue, they always quote to me these numbers. Look at everything that we're doing. Can you help me and everybody else understand, what is the definition of entitled? You touched on this a little bit, right? Like, there are a lot of things that are entitled, but that we can't build because there's no bridge to that, to that location. So tell me what entitled means, if you would. And I worry that cities present the definition of entitled as though it's like, well, we've done everything we can do, and now we're just sitting here waiting. You know, they can go in and put in the housing whenever they want. But I don't think that's true either. And I wish we had a common understanding of what these things mean so that we have a sense about what is actually going on and what our shortage actually is.
Well, I appreciate you asking that question, because I think you are asking the million-dollar question of what are the specific obstacles to getting housing built, right? With, when we think of the land use development process, we need to think about it as a funnel. So the first step in that entitlement process is when the city actually grants that property right to develop to that property owner. So the property owner will come in, and let's use, for the explanation of the process, let's use a greenfield area that right now may be zoned agricultural. So it's zoned agricultural, but the long-term vision is this area is going to eventually develop. It's going to eventually have housing, and it's going to have commercial areas, industrial areas, etc. So the city says long-term, we expect this area is going to develop. The city is going to plan for that long-term development. They need to plan for roads. They need to plan for utilities. They need to plan for all those pieces. Property owner comes in and says, we would like to have the zone change, which is the entitlement, which then entitled us to build the number of units on this particular piece of ground. So that will happen either through zoning or development agreement. Sometimes you do a development agreement because the zone change request is so far ahead of the general plan that you need to have a development agreement to figure out how you're going to pay for all those infrastructure needs, because it's ahead of what the capital facilities plan is for the city. Or sometimes you have development agreements as you're working out different back and forths between what the property owner wants and what the city needs. So when you get to that entitlement, either, you know, when you get to that entitlement through zoning, the property owner can walk out of the city knowing that they have a property right to develop the property based on, for conversation purposes, 5 units to the acre. So they know they can do 5 units to the acre. They've got that entitlement in place. But like you said, the entitlement does not necessarily mean the next day they can go put a shovel in the ground. That's where we start to get into the funnel. So you'll get that entitlement. Sometimes you'll get the entitlement years in advance. But that entitlement is a legislative act. So it has to go through ultimately get approval by the city council. So when we talk about, you know, zoning as a legislative act, that zoning action is the legislative act. It can be referred once the referendum window passes. That entitlement is in place, and now the property owner can move to the next step. So then what's the next step? This starts to get to the funnel. The next step is working out what does your preliminary plan look like, what is the infrastructure needs that you have for that particular property, how does that fit into the larger system infrastructure needs, and that's what this commission's bill last year really tried to refine. Is after you've got your entitlement in place, now you get to, you're subdividing the land. What is, how many back and forths occur between the city or the county and the property?
And more than back and forth, my question on that is, okay, so a city says, we approve this density for this piece of ground.
Yep.
And I'll have some more questions about the timing of that mm-hmm. later.
Yep.
But once that act is done, what power does the city have to hold that up in its future process, right?
Yeah.
Like, so still a developer could come in, okay, here's my plan to put the 1,000 homes on that property, and the city can say, well, I don't like that plan. Correct?
So they are entitled to the density and the laws that are in place in the ordinance at the time of the entitlement, right? There are other zoning pieces of the puzzle. So, for example, you could be entitled to 5 units to the acre. But then as you work through other pieces of the zoning, setbacks being an obvious example, the developer needs to create a plan that fits with all of those other pieces of the zoning.
Fair enough. So this is leading to my question.
Yeah.
So there's a number on here. I mean, let's say we you can put 5 units to the acre on this piece of ground, and it's 10 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you can put 50 homes.
Yeah, I'm glad you did the math on the fly.
Okay. So, but that's not really true because not all of those are developable acres, right? Like in that, that property developer is going to have to put in roads and setbacks and parking and water retention, and all of that is going to eat up acreage. My question is, mm-hmm. does this number represent 50 because we agreed for 5 units to the acre and there are 50 acres, or does it take into account the fact that all of that other stuff is going to eat up acreage and it's really not going to be that big?
Well, yeah, you're asking the right questions because this is why a city or a county would sit down with the property owner, and the property says, okay, I'm entitled to this amount, but I recognize I have to set aside land for roads. I recognize that the school district wants land for the school. I recognize there are these other pieces of community building, but I'm still entitled to 5 units the acre. And so the city and the property owner will work through how to achieve the entitlements, but also achieve all of those other pieces of community planning so that you do, from a property owner perspective, get what you're entitled to receive. And there have been times where I've seen plans go back.
But so does that mean on this 10-acre plot, the 50 homes is the number?
Yes.
And if 3 acres of that have to be taken away for roads and water or whatever, and now there's only 7 acres, I can still build 50 homes on those 7 acres?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, under the entitlement. Now,
okay.
I'm going to actually make the argument for developers for a moment just to be fair to this conversation, and because I'm sure they'll bring it up later too. Sometimes you'll run into realistic constraints where, yes, you're still entitled to those units, but maybe you can't fit all the units you wanted to fit because of those other factors. That's why you have that back and forth, because they are entitled to that. And so the city and the developer will work to get to that entitlement number while recognizing that the city has the responsibility to plan for the roads and the sidewalks and those other pieces. But they are entitled to that first number. And what last year's bill did was, getting to your question a moment ago of, how can the city, quote unquote, delay the project? One of the frustrations that we have frequently heard from our partners on the development side is that the developers would submit a preliminary plan, they'd submit an infrastructure plan, and it would go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth with multiple red lines. What last year's bill did was cap the number of red lines that can go back and forth, so that there's more predictability to that process. There's now a maximum of 4 steps that can go back and forth. That was a major concession on our end. The major concession on the developer side, because I want to give them credit for this too, the concession that they made was that now going forward, once SB 174 and House Bill 406 are fully implemented, they have to meet all of the items that our engineers have redlined back to them. So they move on from step one to step two and step two to step three, once they've hit everything that has been redlined. So the effort was to essentially elevate the bar for both sides. They have to respond to our red lines. We have a limited number of red lines back and forth. You get more predictability in the process, and now it's a 2-step subdivision process, preliminary review, and then the final review. That 4-step infrastructure process can occur at either one of those phases, but it's still just a maximum of 4. So kind of thinking back to the funnel example, you've got the big entitlements, and a property owner will make the decision based on market factors or financing or other things of when they want to move forward developing their property. They'll come to the city and they'll start working out how do we meet all the infrastructure needs, how do we meet public safety needs. For example, you'll often have conversations of, we need to have a fire station, or we need to have these other public uses that are going to serve this property. So you have this conversation go back and forth. And state law provides parameters of what cities can reasonably exact and expect from those property owners in that back and forth. And again, the underlying entitlement still is that 50 units on those 10 acres. So you'll work through a process where it's entitled, then you'll go from that entitlement phase to a preliminary review. You get the approval of the preliminary review. The applicant then moves forward to the final plat review where it's ready for building. It still doesn't mean necessarily that they're going to pull a building permit because, again, the private sector has, they've got a whole bunch of considerations that they need to meet as well when it makes sense for them to start construction and pull a building permit. So, there are things both sides can do during that entitlement process where you go from 165,000 entitled units to the final number of permitted units, which for the last 5 years has averaged about 27,000.
Okay. I appreciate that, and I appreciate your clarity. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to get some of that stuff on the record, and we'll let some other That's great. But as we get – maybe I'll save my closing comments for who do we have raising their hand? Go ahead. Mr. Gambrulis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris Gambrulis, representing the Utah Home Builders Association. I appreciate that back and forth discussion. As a practitioner of this process, practitioner of land development, I would just want to add in, I think that to use the number, the entitled units, I think is helpful because it gives us a baseline of how many units potentially have been approved. It doesn't necessarily say, however, that they have formally been approved either through a development agreement or through a rezone process. And I'll just use an example. Salt Lake City in 2000 entitled thousands upon thousands of multifamily units along the 4 South Corridor. They changed their general plans and they rezoned a lot of properties, entitling these properties. But it took 20 years to get them to the market. The tracks line up to the University of Utah, was functional, by 2002, and it took the market to catch up to those, almost two decades. The entitled number, can be, fungible. What I really want to know is how many are actually entitled by either a development agreement or by an approved plat. This discussion is a good triangulation of a couple of the issues that I've raised in this last year on behalf of the Homebuilder Association, and that is the speed with which residential applications are processed versus non-residential applications. And we did make good progress, and Cameron, I give him all the credit in the world for bringing that issue to fruition in the last legislative session around the number of, the number of red lines. But that came about because of the difficulty of processing residential applications, even getting these development agreements approved. And I think I've mentioned several times in this body before given the example of, the same city where we were processing a master plan community, it took us 3 years from the time we made our first application to get our first 30 single family lots into the ground. And at the same time, the same city processed an industrial distribution facility in 4 months, including their building permit. They were processing this applicant's building permit at the same time they were processing their general plan amendment. And they were under construction in 4 months. And it took us over 2 years before we could start construction. And so when we raised the issue of entitlements, yes, it does have to do with infrastructure. It also has to do with how long it takes to bring product to market because of what the drivers are for city governments and local governments and its tax base and its economic development. And it's the view that residential development is a net negative and not a net positive for a community because it's viewed through the prism of just tax collection versus versus creating a city. So it was a good back and forth. I'd say the two biggest hurdles are local governments wanting to approve in a timely manner residential and lack of infrastructure. It's one thing to go sign a development agreement and entitle a couple of thousand units on a few hundred acres. It's another thing to do it knowing that it's decades away because there's no sewer outfall or there's no water outfall. Those two things are just not, I don't think you can count the units that have been approved where there's just no, realistic window to get infrastructure there.
Thank you, Chris. And Cameron, just to close, is there anybody else that has raised their hand online that wanted to tell? Okay. So I'd say the frustration that I have started expressing about this when I hear this from cities is that, you know, we'll go in and say there are literally no homes that are affordable for sale in the Salt Lake County market for people who make below the median income. And the response back is, well, we've entitled, you know, 25, these four cities have entitled 50,000 units, as though that is responsive to the complaint, right? We're trying to figure out what can we do to make it so that the supply and the demand of housing are in a better equilibrium so that we don't see the prices running up so high. There are a lot of things that are completely out of the control of both the developers and the cities, right? Mm-hmm. Inflation and the ability to get capital from all those things are outside of our control, and that's fine. They're outside the legislature's control. But there are things that are within our control, and I wish that what I would hope that you would be able to provide to us is more numbers that are responsive to the concern, right? Like if we say we have 1,000 units but no bridge to a lot, well, to me that's not part of the total. If what we're working on is we have an affordability crisis today and we can't solve that by approving a lot for 1,000 homes where there's no access, maybe we need to create some other definition besides just entitled. But what I really mean is ready to build within a reasonable time frame. This is what we've got. And we've got a plan to get utility there or to build the bridge so that we can actually use this to increase the supply to make it more in line with the demand. You can go ahead and respond if you'd like.
Well, I think the good news, Senator Fillmore, is I think our members want to be problem solvers in the crisis. And that's why over the last few years, our members have endorsed legislation that's come through this commission, like the stationary plans and subdivisions, recognizing, as you said, we can't control market forces, but we can plan for housing. So how are we planning for it? I think part of the reason they give you that response is a sense of frustration that they feel from the legislature or others saying cities aren't doing their part. So they're saying, well, the core thing of what we can do is entitled units, right? So we've done that. Your frustration is a fair one as well, saying, okay, so you've entitled it, now what? Where can we work together to ensure that units that are entitled, as much as we can on the city side, remove obstacles to get them built? So I hear you loud and clear on that. Part of my emphasis on these different infrastructure challenge pieces is I think there are obstacles in infrastructure that if the state and local government partner together to fund, like that the example I gave of the water tank and the sewer lines where the state did step in and provide $4 million to finish the project, that unlocked those units, removed that obstacle, allowed the city and the property owners to work together, and ideally get some of those units built to help address the crisis.
No, and that's a good example because we identified places where the cities and we could work. And then, you know, like if nobody is going to be, the market is just like we're not going to be interested in 7.5% interest rates, then that's out of our, that's outside of our control, right? But at least we've done everything we could. So anyway, thank you. Appreciate that.
Well, thank you for the time.
Andrew? Andrew, you got a comment? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made a comment a second ago about we can't control the market, which I think we agree to overall, but I think sometimes perhaps we undervalue our ability to affect it in some ways. It's money, right? Interest rates are money. It's about lending. It's about capital. Infrastructure is money and workforce and materials. But if we took a broader view perhaps of us as a state and our ability to raise capital and our ability to influence development of infrastructure and our ability to do those things, we could actually help the market in some ways. It's not completely out of our control unless we choose to say we're not going to. And I know perhaps that's a bigger discussion than we've had here and really goes to the fundamental questions about the role of government here. But I think we could probably do a lot, perhaps, if we chose to do it on that scale.
Okay. Thank you so much. Wayne.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Wow. Been in this space for many, many years, a housing developer. Come a long way, actually, over the years. Mm-hmm. And, well, I was first in the legislature back in 2006. And through my time in the legislature, I think I was put on every affordable housing commission and council and task force that we ever.
And you're still here.
But deeply affordable housing, right? You know, there's really, it feels like we've been looking for the silver bullet. Mm-hmm. And there is none. There is no silver bullet. And on the continuum of housing costs and affordability, the city is just one part of this. Yeah. It's, there's a lot of components there. And it's great to justify that we're doing enough, but it's not enough at the end of the day. The whole continuum mm-hmm. has to continue mm-hmm. to dig deep to create more housing and more affordable housing. And so I think it's great that we applaud what we've done, but it isn't enough. And we need to continue to dig deep into these policies and approaches. And I wouldn't be the homeless coordinator if I didn't take an opportunity to say this, that, you know, let's take advantage of infrastructure that we have, the extra capacity in infrastructure. I live in a city that had probably the highest number of children at one point, 30, 40 years ago, and now that whole demographic has changed. And so there's a lot of extra capacity in the homes, in the sewer systems, water systems in that city, because they just don't have the same family dynamics. Let's take advantage of those and really emphasize ADUs in many ways. These are the types of things that will create some units that are more deeply affordable, workforce affordable, and those are some things I just don't think we're doing enough with. So, okay. I think that's where we really need to dig deep as a continuum to create that more affordable housing so that we've got places for people to go. We've got a deficit, 150,000 deficit in workforce housing, 77,000 in deeply affordable. Got a long way to go.
Thank you. And, yes, hurry, though. Public comment has taken up more than a half hour.
I
know that's my
that.
Fault. But.
I know. I just wanted to talk about an ancillary piece to this. The HTRZ funding components to allow the all of the involved parties, including the school districts, as well as those cities, water districts, et cetera, to really kind of look at some of the strategies involved in that. There is a lot of momentum, and that is the piece that we're talking about, which is that infrastructure piece. granted, candidly, it is only at station areas. But I do think that there is a tremendous amount of interest and excitement about, if they have an opportunity to do this, then they're trying to maximize it. Candidly, the committee members, Representative Schultz, Senator Harper, really have been focusing on getting that affordable housing piece. And it's typically above the 10% requirement. And so there is long-term goal. And I just wanted to articulate that, because I do think that that has, that addresses the one challenge that was articulated, that how do you get that infrastructure built? So there is options out there. I know it's limited, and I will say that, but anyway, just want to make that comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have a quorum? We're going to take a motion on the minutes. Would somebody make a motion to, Beth, your mic's on, make a motion to approve the minutes of June 6th, August 1st, and September 5th?
Mr. Yes, so moved.
Thank you. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, great. We have a second. All right, so we have a motion and a second to approve the minutes. Any discussion of that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Everybody online tonight, are there any opposed? Seeing none, I declare that the minutes are officially approved. Our next item, we're going to hear from Habitat for Humanity. Cameron took up a lot of your time. All right.
You're going to want to pull that real close. I'll do my best to get you back on schedule. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to address the commission. At the table with me is Ed Blank. My name is Corey Holdaway. I do work with Habitat for Humanity across the state. At the table with me are the executive directors of the Utah County Habitat for Humanity and Salt Lake Valley Habitat for Humanity. There are five affiliates for Habitat for Humanity across the state. They all work independent from one another, but have the same mission of Habitat for Humanity International. Last year, we had a request that came before the legislature that was honored with regard to critical home repair. Today, we want to give you a brief report about the critical home repair funding that that came to Habitat for Humanity. In addition to that, one of their missions, and an important part of their mission, is construction of new homes and construction of homes that are in the affordable realm. So with that, I'm going to just briefly, let me just, I want to, the five affiliates that we have in the state are in St. George, Iron, Utah County with Alan, Salt Lake with Ed, and Ed covers Davis, Tooele, and Salt Lake. Then we also have Summit and Wasatch Habitat for Humanity, and then there's a Northern Habitat for Humanity. And each one of them are struggling in similar ways, which brings us to you today. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ed and Alan.
Would you be kind enough to give us the first slide? Thank you. And thank you for having us here today to talk to you. Why Habitat? Why would you want to consider our ask at Habitat? For one thing, our homes are a community asset. Mortgages have zero interest. We not only work on the price of the house, we work on the payment for the house as well. Our houses have zero interest, which lowers the payment. Right now in Salt Lake County, we're building at about $350,000 to finish a house off. And with 0%.
Is that inclusive of the land cost?
All of it.
Okay.
With 0% mortgage, that's a mortgage payment of about $950 a month just for the mortgage. Many of our families are moving from higher rent into our homes right now. So we're an asset that goes into the community. The mortgage is paid back to Habitat. We put it back out into the community again. So the investment does not leave. It keeps rotating ongoing. Stabilizing home ownership disrupts intergenerational poverty. That's something to consider. We know that children thrive when you can put their roots down in a community. We dedicated a house last year to a single father of four. They'd moved five times in the last 5 years. And that's really, really hard on the children when that happens. Alan, would you like to pipe up about children for just a moment?
We did a impact study 2 years ago that surveyed all the homes that we've built families for over the last 30 years, and to try to demonstrate and really understand the impact that we're making beyond just providing somebody a home. What are the longer term benefits? And there was a lot of interesting things that came out of it. Four out of five of them said that they've improved their household health and wealth. More than two-thirds said that their children's attendance and their school grades actually improved by having a stable home environment. The 90%, over 90% said that they now foresee some opportunity to send their children to college, that they've got an affordable home, an affordable their finance situation is dramatically improved. So that was pretty interesting. And about half of them had already started or completed some type of higher education that they would not have been able to do otherwise. Again, freeing them up in other different ways. And one of my favorite stats is that over 80% of the families that we built homes for were receiving some type of government assistance prior to moving into their home, over 80%. After moving into their home, we cut that in half. So less than half of those were receiving some type of government assistance, and over two-thirds of those stopped needed to receive food assistance because now that their housing costs have gone down, they can actually afford to eat. So there was it was a lot of different things. It's not just the affordable house, the affordable home. It's all the trickle-down effects that we get from schools and their children, and it turns into generational opportunities for advancement.
Thanks, Alan. Habitat for Humanity affiliates have decades of experience of building houses in Utah. We work for the seventh largest home building organization in the United States. And so we have experience with this. Why Habitat? Because we know what we're doing as it goes to affordable housing. Who are our Habitat partner families? Participating families provide hundreds of hours of sweat equity to get into a Habitat house. We consider that their down payment. They work alongside volunteers and get those hours in, and that's basically their stake in the game, is the volunteer hours that they put in. All of our families are working families, making between 30 and 80% AMI. And volunteers come and help build those houses that you see in our Habitat developments. And so the community supports our organization as well.
Ed, if I could just interject here, the 30 to 80% AMI, obviously that's there's a difference in each of the different counties, whether it's a rural county versus an urban county. Salt Lake's AMI is a little bit higher. I'm sure you all are aware of that.
So what's our legislative ask? If I can get the next slide. Thank you. We're asking for $5 million in the next session. And we've been here before to ask for funding, but it wasn't statewide. And the members told us we'd really like to see an ask statewide. Show us what you're going to do in the other areas of the state. And that's why we're here today. There are five Habitat affiliates in Utah. This ask would put $1 million in each affiliate across the state. The funding would be used for land acquisition, infrastructure costs, construction costs, design costs, and 10% would fund project delivery. The reason it's across that spectrum is because we're all building right now. Today we're building houses, and the affiliates are in different stages of building as we go across the state. Some are looking for land, some are building walls, and so that's why the scope is there across that dynamic. State coverage. Allison, if you'd give me the next one. Thank you. This gives you an idea of the population bases that we cover. Salt Lake Valley Habitat for Humanity just picked up Davis County. We're new in Davis County, but we've got that up and running now. All of these counties represent 88% of the population of Utah in our housing program and the services that we provide. And so by this ask, we're getting a much better net across the entire state for affordable housing. I told you I'd be brief.
Let me just interject here a couple of things. One of the points that I'd like to make is prior to last year, Habitat for Humanity as a nonprofit organization had not gotten any funding from the government or from the state. That said, when you look across the country in other states, Habitat is utilized to be able to help with the affordable housing crisis in other areas of the country. Given their mission and what they do and the model that they have, I think this is a reasonable ask for the state to utilize the Habitat model for this need. So
thank you, Corey. Questions?
First, I'm going to go to Representative White.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being this morning and sharing the good work that Habitat Humanity is doing throughout the state and helping so many people. With the $5 million ask and $1 million going to each of the different affiliates, what would be the end impact in one of those affiliate areas? How many additional new units, homes would be built with $1 million per affiliate?
So we're going to bring the money that we've been raising for decades alongside that money as well. So this is money that's coming from fundraising. It's from basically all of the methods and channels that we've had for raising money in the past. So I guess what I would say is the money can easily have a 4X or 5X effect when we bring it into our program. One of the difficulties that Habitat has in our projects is land and infrastructure is not very sexy, quite frankly. And a lot of times when we bring in money like this, it helps us get over that hump. Everyone wants to come out and put up a wall, or everyone wants to come out and do what I would term the sexy stuff. This really helps us with the hard stuff that we've got to do to get a project up and running. And so, again, all of the affiliates would be in different stages of building. But we would bring this alongside the funding that we already have, and it would energize that funding. The other thing it does is the money never leaves because it comes back. Well, now we have another $1 million that's in our core base that we're building houses with because it's always ongoing.
And you're constantly building homes, right? You envision this as a one-time appropriation, right? Helps you get some acquisition.
Yes.
Then you use other funding to build the homes. What? So you build a home, you sell it, then what?
Then we move to the next home. But one thing we do is
that is who gives you $350,000 in cash?
So at the onset or at the mortgage? Are you at the back end or are you at
no,
the
I mean, so you built a house for $350,000.
Mm-hmm.
Who pays, you know, who writes the check to Habitat for that home?
So when we bring in the partner family, they're given a 30-year mortgage, and they pay back every dime that we ever gave to them.
Right, I understand.
That's how it comes
but
back.
They don't write you a check for $350,000.
No, they don't.
But somebody does.
It's over 30
so
years.
Who's the mortgage holder?
Habitat. We hold the mortgage for 30 years, and in some cases.
Then does it take you 30 years to be able to repay that investment to build another home?
The answer has been yes. However, last year we put together a program with Utah Housing Corp where we will do the mortgage, but they buy the mortgage at the back end. And it goes to them for 30 years, and we get our $350.
Well, okay, so that was my question, right?
Yeah.
So then you're getting your capital back quickly enough that you can reinvest it in. And then when that family sells the home, then what happens?
There are contingencies that they can't. They don't share in any of the equity of the home for 5 years.
Okay.
And then it's a stepped-up program after that. Habitat retains first right of refusal to buy back any of those homes that we wish.
Thank you. That was my question. How do we keep them in the market? All right. Who's online that has questions? Janice?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd just like to say our agency, Housing Connect, has a family self-sufficiency program, and one of the ways our families have been able to move into home ownership has been through a partnership with Habitat. Second, I had a question about the 10% project delivery. Is that admin?
This is going to pay for management of the program on the construction site. We have that there. And then we have internal admin that works with the cities and permitting and things along those lines. That's primarily where that 10% would go.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there more online? Okay. Thank you. We really appreciate your presentation. Your ask is for us to add $5 million to our funding requests, and we'll take that up when we get to the funding request section. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Next, we have land use and construction regulations by Ari Bruning and Ryan Beck. We welcome you to the witness table. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us today. I'm Ari, he's Ryan, so you can keep it straight. We were contracted by the Department of Workforce Services to do an evaluation of the impact of regulation on housing affordability and to make recommendations. So we are here reporting back on our findings. So if you'll go to the next slide. There we go. Here we had a three-phase process that we went through. The first thing we did was we did interviews with quite a number of builders and cities and housing experts, and we put together a stakeholder group composed of the same sorts of folks to guide us through this process. And then we were contracted to look at 35 different local governments ordinances, and we also did a nationwide literature review to see what the research said about what was most effective in reducing housing prices. And then we are now reporting back what we found. The ink is starting to get dry on the report, and that should be available pretty soon. But just to dive into what we found, if you go to the next slide. First of all, so at Envision Utah, we survey Utahns pretty regularly. We are now seeing that this issue is people's number one concern about life in Utah. Years ago it was air quality, and now it's housing affordability. And it affects so many other issues that we deal with as a state, whether it's transportation or water use. Smaller lots use less water, for example. Even things that you might not expect, like how many kids people have. There's evidence that people delay childbearing because of housing prices. So with that, I think I'm going to skip the next couple slides because we all know that housing prices are high in Utah, and we're motivated to do something about it. So we were contracted to look at land use regulation. As has been mentioned several times today, there are lots of other things that affect housing costs besides land use regulation, whether that's supply chains and materials costs or labor costs, land costs, interest rates, and so on. But it does come down to supply and demand, and we've had a lot of supply constraints and also some pretty high demand in Utah. And lest everybody think it's Californians moving in, I wanted to focus you on that chart on the left. I believe we have the largest millennial generation in the country percentage-wise, and our Generation Z is pretty large too, and they're all in their prime home buying years. So a lot of that demand is homegrown. These are our own kids we're talking about. And by the way, they delayed household formation coming out of the Great Recession for several years, and now are forming their own households. Now, if you'll go to the next slide, wrong way. Down. We, as I mentioned, we did a nationwide literature review, and it turns out that reducing housing regulation does indeed increase construction of housing and reduce housing costs. The theory works. You regulate something less, you get more of it. In particular, the things that turned out to have the biggest impact were reduced minimum lot sizes, number one, increasing allowable units. So that might be, for example, more than one unit on a lot, so an ADU, or that might be a duplex or a threeplex or townhomes, something like that. And then other density increases help as well. So floor area ratios and height restrictions and so forth. Those came out of the top. And fortunately, when we talked to all of our stakeholder group, those came out at the top with them too. Lot sizes came out number one, and more units on the lot came out number two. So, and then we also have been involved in the guiding our growth process where we surveyed Utahns and found quite an appetite for the same kinds of things. So it's nice when everything points in the same direction. Then we looked at our 35 ordinances around the state. I can't promise that they're representative of all local governments. These are 35 that we picked to try to be representative. We were asked to look at every AOG, so if anything, it's a little rural heavy on the sample size we looked at. We found, first of all, your typical zoning ordinance has a minimum lot size of 10,000 square feet. Most cities don't allow much of anything under 7,000 square feet. And we also found that most multi-unit housing, so think duplexes, threeplexes, those kinds of things, are limited to multi-family zones, which tend to be fairly small. And we also found that mixed-use development is often not allowed. Most retail zones are retail only. Now, I should note that these findings are, we were looking at what is allowed by right in the zoning ordinance. As Cam presented earlier, there are a lot of these kinds of things that are being permitted through development agreements and planned community zones. But I should also note that allowing them by right can make quite a bit of difference, because then you don't have to go through a discretionary zoning approval process and development agreement. And particularly for a small-scale developer, that kind of process could be pretty daunting. So with that, we took all this information and we put together some recommendations, and I'm going to turn it to Ryan to walk us through the recommendations.
All right. I appreciate that, Ari. And I'm going to do my best to get us back on schedule. So I have 13 recommendations, some for local, some for state. Please slow me down if I'm going too fast. Ari just mentioned the 10,000. We were finding when we did that, those reviewing those local ordinances, we found a lot of cities that were requiring 10,000 square feet. Recommendation here is to allow smaller lot sizes. We're talking about 5,000 square feet to help us create this inventory of attainable homes. And Alyssa, skip that one. So let's, as an example, this is, and to me, this really illustrates the point. It's genius, but it's simple. I love that. So what we've got here in the is 30,000 square feet residential land. We've divided that up into three lots, 10,000 square foot each. We put the same home on each of those, about 2,500 square feet. Home price being 412,000. Land price 311,000. Of course, builders need to make a profit, 10% there. So total home price is about $800,000. Compare that with the same 30,000 square foot, but what we've done here is put 5,000 square foot lots and put six homes, doubled our homes, same home, same home price. The land price is quite a bit less. Again, we have builder profit. $625,000 is the bottom line there. That's a savings of $175,000. That's real money. That would hit my budget, you know. So I love that graphic to help illustrate that point. 22% price reduction. Second recommendation for local is to allow, thanks, Alyssa, allow more than one housing unit per lot and per building. What I love about this picture, you can see on the screen, this is what they call a mansion home in South Jordan. There's three units in that building there. My personal opinion is that does not take away from the character of a community. I think that is a nice design. And we can really make some progress with products like this. All right. Local recommendation number three is facilitate smaller homes. The household size in Utah has been declining since 1970, and yet we've been increasing the square footage of our homes. So naturally, those are more expensive. This is a tough one because the market seems to be looking towards these larger homes. That's what the market wants. So, but it is one of our recommendations that facilitating the smaller homes. All right, mixed-use development. Slide, please. Allowing multifamily housing in our commercial and our office zones to help us promote this mixed-use development. I think, and I'm not talking about, retail that's healthy. We know that cities depend on that for their tax base, but there's probably places in your community that you can think of, older atrophying big box stores or overparked areas that could have some housing added to those areas. So consider that, consider the mixed use development, and really look at those parking requirements when you do that. Thanks, Alyssa. And this recommendation number 5 about reducing the delays and the cost of development, you know, some of the recent legislation has about the number of times you can go back and forth has definitely helped with that. But what we're hearing when we did all those interviews that Ari spoke to, that these codes are really complicated and they're hard to get through. And so simplifying these codes could go a long, long ways. Considered pattern-based zoning in some areas if that's appropriate. And then, all right, moving on to the next one. And then facilitate the use of off-site construction. And this we found would be really useful in rural areas that have a shortage of labor. But manufactured homes are not what they were in the 70s and 80s, and maybe we've painted ourselves into a corner, but modular homes are pretty awesome. They have they're very high quality. But the recommendation here is adopting standards for construction inspection and compliance. I'll loop back on this one at the state level. All right, moving on to state state recommendations. And this is about education. Educate the public about the need for more housing. The point here is that elected officials at the, you know, at the local level tend to listen to those people who are out talking to, talking in their ear. So a campaign that connects the local zoning regulations to high impact or to the high housing prices could be very impactful. And then on the other side, that was the number one was the public, but number two is about training materials for local government officials. You know, where we elect new people into office all the time. Oftentimes they come in with the being elected on a platform of anti-growth. So educational materials for the local government officials could go a long, long way to help promote our housing attainability and affordability and maybe how they could address those concerns at the city level. This state recommendation is very interesting to me. The recommendation here is to do an in-depth analysis of land and water and where we could be building, especially along the Wasatch Front. I'm going to call out here Davis County as an example here. You can see in the blue that we have about 11,000 remaining developable acres in Davis County. The projections, the Kempsey Gardner projections are through 2060, and they say we're going to have the need for about 112,000 housing units. So just basic math, not even taking out like infrastructure, roads, stuff like that. That's pretty high density, not densities that we're building to. So we need to really, I think the recommendation of doing an in-depth analysis makes a lot of sense. All right, number 4 here is assisting communities with transportation infrastructure. Oftentimes, you know, when we were interviewing city officials and city planners, they kept saying, hey, the public is screaming in our ear about peak traffic and traffic congestion, and, you know, and the city councils tend to listen to that. So helping with the transportation infrastructure, state level helping with the transfer, might soften this community opposition to more density. All right, 5. This one is specifically talking about condominium development. You know, condos are a great product. They allow people to get into the housing market, maybe get a toehold, build a little equity. But what we found is that there's a lot of non-zoning barriers to condominium development. Ari was telling me that he looked into the financing requirements, and oftentimes the financing requires 50% of the units to be sold up front. Which is, you know, a pretty big challenge when you're talking condominium development. So look at those non-zoning barriers, financing as an example, to help promote these entryways into ownership. Slide, Alyssa. All right. And this one's this recommendation number 6 talks about, parking is very expensive. You talk to any developer, they know how expensive parking is, and it really can make or break a development. But in our transit-oriented developments, in our city centers, consider state-level financing for structured parking to help out with that problem there. And then number seven is, I'm back to the modular homes, and this is about at state level standardizing the plan review for these off-site construction for these modular homes. I'm talking about the structure. I'm not talking about, you know, the lot requirements, grading, et cetera. You know, that probably should be kept at the city or the county level, because they tend to know what's going on there. But the structure, we could have a standardized review and inspection process. So with that, I know it was quick. We are happy to try to field your questions.
Any questions? The one that I have would be, would you be able to provide to me and my co-chair here a list of policy recommendations that you think fall at the state level? A lot of, there is a mix in here, right? Here are a lot of things that cities should do, and here are a lot of things that the state should do. I'd appreciate having those.
Absolutely.
Just a list. Here's some things we could consider.
A simple list. We got you.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. Chris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alyssa, would you go to the slide? I don't remember which one it was, but it was the before the recommendations, and it talked about the floor area ratios. Yeah, there you go. Excellent. Thank you. So I just wanted to point this slide out. First off, thanks to Envision Utah, Ari and Ryan for this work. It's going to be really helpful to aid in the discussions that we're going to have on the policy, from the policy working group, in just a few minutes. Allowing more density through reduced minimum lot sizes, increase allowable units, and increasing the floor area ratio, the FAR. What that means in functional terms, those are great. But in functional terms, what we're talking about is smaller lots and smaller setbacks within areas. And I want to point out that Envision Utah is now endorsing, this policy, right, Ari? Cause you endorse these things. What they're saying is that the area of lots that are set aside for setbacks reduces the efficiency of the lots. Now, Alyssa, will you go to the slide that shows the three lots on 30,000 square feet? That's perfect. So an acre is 43,560 square feet. Typically, within an acre on a typical, say it's an, in this case, these are 10,000 square foot lots, your yield, would actually be about 2.7 or 2.8 units per acre. You actually don't get 3 units per acre because you're setting aside about 25 to 27% of your gross area for roads. And so in this case, you're actually probably have about 1.2 acres and you've got these three lots. Now, if you go to the next slide and you've got these six lots, if you go to the next slide, these 5,000 square foot lots, and with the same home size and reduced setbacks, can drive down the cost of housing. Now, is $625,000 affordable? No, but it is more affordable. It is less expensive than the previous slide. And that's a really important distinction is, one of the criticisms of this policy is that it doesn't create affordable housing. But the point here, and I just want to point this out, is it is more affordable, and that is something that also helps housing affordability. But I appreciate the work that Envision Utah has put into this, and look forward to our other conversations. But I did want to, during this presentation point out that those these policy considerations that Ari and Ryan have raised are in alignment with some of the policy conversations we're going to have in a few minutes. So thanks.
Thank you. Representative Briscoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should know it, but what does FAR mean?
Floor area ratio.
Okay. Someone from Envision Utah was here several years ago during a presentation at a committee I was on. Envision Utah, you're one of the unsung heroes of planning in Utah because you don't tell people we must do it this way. You say, here's some possibilities. And you've done some design toolkits and planning toolkits. And you were talking about some future. And a senator reamed you out and was concerned because you were showing the lot sizes were shrinking. And I just wanted to have the little, to be the NFL coach, you know, me being up in the box, calling the plays down to the field, right? Yeah. So what you could have responded was, Senator, we understand that you might have this vision of all homes sit on a lot this size, but what's happening now is supply and demand, market forces. And I think Chris Gambroulis, in an earlier meeting this year, described what it was like to have people coming out to developments they're working on, and they go, we want that house on that lot, and it's $1 million. And they go home, and they come back, okay, well, show us smaller houses on smaller lots. We've got this beautiful state. We've got people who live here who don't want to move. We're now getting people who want to move here for the mountains, for the amenities, for the experiences, for the schools. We're hot.
Yeah.
People want to live here. There's only so much land.
If I may, I'd like to respond a little bit to that. I think sometimes people want the large lots because they view that as being pro-family. And in reality, if that's all we allow, that's anti-family because that means young families can't afford ownership and can't build equity and can't move up the ladder. And so I think this strategy is a pro-family strategy. And I also want to react to what Chris Gambroulis said too about, this is more affordable to do those six lots rather than three. That's absolutely true. And probably more important is you also built twice as many units. And what we're trying to do is to get the units and the demand into equilibrium. And so more units is the goal.
You also tapped the golden calf, the elephant in the room, which is house size.
Yeah.
I mean, I have friends who are architects who tell me people come in and say, design me this house. And they go, people could live in one of those rooms. Or two, they could take two rooms of that house and they can live in it. And there are no starter homes anymore. People get married, they want to move into the 6,000 square foot house. We got to talk about it. Thanks.
Beth Holbrook.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask you a quick question. I have three comments, actually. The first one is on parking. Did you do any recommendations for parking, or was it more of a general, we need to look at our parking and make a determination?
We did not. I mean, we dug in at least at the city level. We did, you know, look at some of the residential stuff and found cities that had pretty high parking requirements and felt a little onerous and restrictive. But we did veer away. We could have literally spent the whole budget looking at a parking study because it is so complicated and is case by case. So to answer your question, we kept it pretty high level on the parking.
Thank you. And then my next question is, and this is just a comment from the discussion. This actually goes back to my previous comment about HTRZs. Is there an opportunity to do a structured parking or an infrastructure statewide funding mechanism of some kind? Because as in any stationary plan that we're seeing right now, this average structured parking cost per parking spot is between $25,000 and $30,000 on structured parking. That's a big chunk of change, and I'm just wondering if there is an opportunity to kind of have that as a discussion piece at some point. And then my last comment is the communications piece. How and why, and not why, how would you envision doing that type of a communication structure? Would you, in essence, be doing something like this?
How do we get to that? I feel like there's two levels. One, we have our elected officials we need to be educating, and I think that's maybe a little bit more direct process. The public who talks to those elected officials is quite a different ball of wax, in my opinion. But the good news is
is we did have a little bit of extra money on this, and we are going to produce some videos with the permission of the Housing and Community Development. So toolkits, toolboxes, educational materials.
I don't know that we've figured out exactly what a public campaign would look like or what the messaging would be. Probably have to be fairly simple. We did put a number to what we thought it would cost to move the needle, and that was $300,000 a year for 2 years to do that kind of campaign. As for the structured parking, I think what you mentioned is pretty much exactly what our recommendation was, that the state look at some sort of state-level financing assistance for that structured parking, because that is a real barrier to creating good TODs and mixed-use development.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We appreciate your time, and we're going to move on.
Thank you.
So the next item on our agenda is the funding update. Christina, I think, who is being very brave, joining us online, even though she's not feeling well. Christina, you wanted to tighten up a couple of things on the funding update. We approved some funding, our funding request at our last meeting. Just wanted to hear from you on an update.
Yes, Nate McDonald, I believe you're going to take over this one.
Okay, go ahead, Nate. I got you. Yeah, thank you. Nate McDonald with Department of Workforce Services. Just to update, last time we prioritized the ongoing in one time, there was one thing that we left off that wasn't prioritized, and it was a new source for funding for homelessness. It was mentioned, and then the question is whether or not we want that added. I don't, Wayne, if it's appropriate to have Wayne mention it, maybe familiarize us on that ask, and what that is. And then the question is for the commission. I mean, really we have two, and with the Habitat presentation in this, whether or not we want to add those as priorities.
All right. Yeah. Wayne, go ahead. So liquor, is there a difference between the liquor tax and the liquor margin?
There is no liquor tax.
It's just
beer
margin
tax,
right? Yeah. And so, right now, this fund, the liquor margin funds school lunches,
right? And a few other things.
Okay, go ahead.
Plus, sends a surplus to the general fund.
Okay, go ahead.
This was a little bit of a difficult situation. I was kind of wondering what we were going to do at the end of the day, and with the $39 million is because it needs to get before the UEOC, and it doesn't quite fit in housing affordability because it's talking about services and shelter and that type of thing, but there really isn't any other pathway there. And so maybe it isn't rated high here in this, but we would like to get it on the priority list. At some kind of a spot there, because
would you like to make a motion to add it to the priority list as a new source of funding for homeless services?
I will make that motion.
Okay. We have a motion before us. Is there a discussion to it? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, yeah, right. Go ahead. Beth seconds it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
And online?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Any opposed? Okay. I'll say that motion passes. While we're here, we also heard from Habitat for Humanity. Is there a motion to add $5 million as a request for Habitat Humanity to as number 3 on the one-time funding list? Representative Briscoe makes the motion. Is there a second? Niederhauser seconds. Any discussion to that? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say no. All right. I declare that motion passes unanimously. We have a new number 3. And I'll just direct staff to update that slide and make sure that we get those in front of UEOC. All right. Let's move on to the policy subgroup. I understand that our presenter here will be Chris Gambrulis. This is the last major item on the agenda. But we're not going to go till noon on this. So Chris, go ahead. Would love to hear your presentation. And I assume you have some slides, right?
I believe Alyssa's got them up.
Okay. We do. Let's go ahead.
We've had some really good discussions. I want to thank both staff, Christina and Alyssa, and our partners at the League of Cities and Towns and the Association of Counties for engaging in these difficult conversations, because policy, you know, this is really the meat of it. This is the hard, these are the hard lifts. There's two major buckets, those that generally have consensus. That doesn't mean that the issues don't have details that need to be worked out, but that the general concepts are things that there won't be necessarily opposition to. The modular housing at the top of the list, state infrastructure funding facilitate housing production. That goes to the parking and other infrastructure we discussed before. Things like, you know, when we take the conversation back to what do entitled lots mean, and the missing infrastructure pieces, the sewer extensions and the water. So it's all of that. The RDA, CRA flexibility. I know that there's some discussions with the RDA folks, especially at Salt Lake City, that there already is a lot of flexibility there. I think we need to dig in and talk about not just the flexibility, but also the deployment of the capital that may be sitting and not be either spent or encumbered. And I use those terms as terms of art. I think those are important. Aligning state funds with alignment for good local planning. I think that's easy for everyone to get behind, as long as the state has some money to do that. The economic development incentives with the production of workforce housing, I mentioned this earlier, around the entitled lots. That is, how do you make sure that when you're approving million square foot buildings with 1,000 employees, that they're going to be able to live within a, you know, proximity of that, or at least have an opportunity to do that. The second to the last one, the improved land use outcomes in the courts. This is a very nuanced issue. It's something that has come up in the land use task force. There's general consensus around it. But it's a hyper technical land use issue, and I would just encourage the members of the CHA to support that. These garage, you know, these parking minimums and those kinds of things. I just encourage the CHA to look at those and give some endorsements for these things that we can move forward with. The next slide, these are issues that are more difficult, because some of them go to, you know, what is zoning? Why do cities exist? I mean, I argue that zoning, cities existed long before zoning ever existed. But we live in a time in the last 100 years when zoning became a very important part of what cities do, and parking minimums, is an issue, and it does drive density, it drives land use efficiency. I'd encourage the CHA to encourage the co-chairs to at least dig into that. Residential setbacks, that's what I interrupted the Envision Utah presentation, the FAR discussion. That's what that means. It is, how do we keep, how do we make what remaining land we have to build on more efficient? And one of those things is to limit the amount of setbacks within residential areas. And our idea is to make that a percentage of the lot size. Making general plans binding, in quotes, that's the legislative adoption of a general plan. I gave a presentation on this a month or so ago, and went through, you know, the the pitfalls as well as the benefits, but I believe that this is something for us to really dig in and understand. In my opinion, as a practitioner of land use and development for the last three decades, I would tell you I think there's probably no policy that would have a bigger impact than making general plans binding, but making the contents of the general plans better. Minimum base densities are something that would go along with the general plan. That would be basically saying that a city would, you know, city X that's 5,000 square acres would have to have 5 units per acre or something like that, 3 units per acre overall. And then that would tie back to the general plans. The financial penalties, I don't know that we ever get to consensus on that. However, I don't think that that's necessarily a reason to not have the conversation around penalties for the violation of civil rights, and civil rights include property rights. And if somebody goes through the process through the courts and demonstrates that their property rights were violated, currently the only thing that party gets is attorney's fees. They don't even get, they don't get damages. And so you could spend a decade in the courts to prove that your property rights were violated, and you get your attorney's fees, and you've spent a decade sitting on your hands. The appeal authority is something that's very nuanced. It goes to the land court that was on the previous list. I would suggest that if there is a land use appeal authority, that one of the things it would have the authority to opine on is back to the general plans. Like, why would somebody appeal a land use decision? The idea is, well, maybe the appeal authority would be looking to see if the moderate income housing plan was really functional. And then at the bottom of this, there's other technical topics that are at the land use task force, and I think we're getting to consensus on those. So I went as fast as I could, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Representative White has a question for you on the prior slide.
Chris, thank you for your work and for the entire subgroup's work over the summer. On the third bullet point down, could you provide a little bit more clarification, explanation of what that means?
Sure. What it means is that go back to the creation of RDAs and EDAs over the last couple of decades. They've been required to set aside a percentage of the TIF that's collected for the creation of affordable housing. And so imagine the City X approves an RDA to get a retail center in their city, or an EDA or something along those lines. It becomes a retail center. And then that TIF that City X now collects and has 20% or 10% of the tax increment that they're supposed to deploy for affordable housing. A lot of times what happens is cities will simply remit that money to Olene Walker or to other funds in the state, rather than create the affordable housing in their own city. Or they simply sit on the money because it's they don't know what to do with it. And our idea is that if we could make sure that there was enough flexibility in the code, that they would be combining resources, potentially if the funds were too small, or simply deploying it. You know, you never want to see a bunch of, you know, several million dollars of affordable housing monies just sitting in an account, because there isn't the political will to deploy that capital within the community where it's collected. So, this is a very technical issue, with RDAs and EDAs and the distinctions and those kinds of things. But the main point, Mr. Co-Chair, is to have some bumpers on the funding to require its deployment within a reasonable time period, even if that means combining, you know, having three or four cities that have small amounts of money, being able to do a single project together and encouraging the use of that funds. Because right now, these are viewed in isolation. They're seldom ever viewed collectively.
Thanks for that additional explanation.
And questions from me, Chris. Can you state funds alignment with good local planning? Tell me what that means. And because I'm looking at this list and thinking, what kind of directions am I going to give to a drafting attorney? And I don't know how to direct on that item.
So that's a summary of a lot of discussions that we've had around how to deploy funds through the Division of Housing to communities to help them do their moderate income housing plans or to do their general plans. You know, one of the concerns that we've heard from local governments is that, you know, updating their general plans is an expensive endeavor. And so sometimes we have really outdated documents. And so I think the idea there is that, that there may be some monies that could help offset that. I know maybe Christina or Cameron want to add some additional context, but that's how I understand it.
Thank you. And what's the missing middle toolkit?
Mr. Chair, I apologize for my voice, but I can speak to both of these.
Okay, go ahead.
The state funds alignment with good local planning, one of the things that we've discovered in concert with all of our partners is that many of the general plans, land use plans, are not updated with long-range planning in mind. They could be updated for building as it stands today, so as built conditions. One of the ideas is that we provide funding to assist local municipalities in really doing a thorough land use planning exercise where they envision where they do want to place certain housing opportunities.
Is there a dollar figure attached to that?
We could mimic it after the subdivisions funding, which was $4 million last year.
Okay. Missing middle toolkit.
Yes, the missing middle toolkit, we're actually going to work in conjunction with the Ombudsman's Office. We believe that there is funding available currently in order to issue an RFP and provide this toolkit and technical assistance to local municipalities. So this would not be an item that we need funding for.
Okay, thank you. Janice, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to speak to the RDA CRA flexibility. I do agree with Chris that there needs to be some flexibility to share between cities and some ways, you know, some expectations of expending the funds timely. I also wanted to remind everyone that there is a provision that the monies can be transferred through a housing authority to a county, so that's another way that those dollars could be expended. And then I also want to focus, I really do feel strongly that those dollars should be used to meet the needs of the deeply affordable, and really there's very few resources that are available to build those multifamily units. So thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments or questions for the subgroup? Go ahead, Joel.
I just want to give a shout out to builders, developers, and cities and towns. I know the builders and developers have a slide of things they didn't get. Consensus on Elon Musk doesn't get everything he wants. But this list is pretty significant, I think. And the list of things that cities and towns and builders and developers have agreed to the last 3 or 4 years, I think we're already starting to see production. The frustration for the public is building a home is not like putting up a website. It can't be done in a day. It can't be done in a year, maybe. It's got a long process. But we've got a lot of really good things in the pipeline, I think, that are starting to show fruition and will show fruition next few years. We're not done, of course. And I appreciate the commitment of ULCT and the building development community to continue to go to the table and talk. I think it's shown positive results and will continue to do so in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrew Johnston.
I echo Joel's comments there a second ago. I think the consensus items are great movement in our most difficult area that I'm aware of. And I would hesitate, I'd be cautious about pushing the non-consensus items at this point. There are strong reasons why they're non-consensus at this point, so they need some more work, I think, collectively to move through those. So thank you.
Okay. Anything further? All right. Thank you, Chris, and the policy committee. Let's talk about next steps, and then I'll ask for some motions. So the UEOC is meeting on Wednesday of next week. Representative White will represent the commission at that meeting in person. I'll be there remotely. There we will outline the decisions that we made today and at our last meeting regarding our the work of our data committee, our funding committee, and our policy committee. So it's going to be up to this commission to adopt something that we will present to UEOC. But neither this commission nor the UEOC has the ability to craft or open legislation, right? And so what ultimately makes it into legislation is up to any number of 104 legislators. And so, you know, Representative White and I both have bill files open that in our mind are CHA bill files. But of course the CHA doesn't control what goes in those bill files, right? Any of the other 102 legislators could take any of these ideas and run with them. And I imagine that some of them will. With that said, what I would like to see is, let's start here. If you could, Alyssa, can you bring up the list of non, consensus items on, from the policy committee? Would anybody like to make a motion to add any of these policy items that currently are without consensus to a recommendation that we would make to UEOC? If so, I will accept a motion to add any number of those to our recommendations. Well, I imagine that we're going to pass a motion to say the consensus items we recommend. So before we get there, I'm wondering, does anybody want to add these items, any of these items, to our recommendations?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would make the motion to add the six items, the parking minimums, residential setbacks, the general plans, minimum base densities, damages, and the appeal authority to the list for consideration at the UEOC.
Okay.
I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second that we would add these for consideration that we would make to the UEOC. Is there any discussion to that? By the way, who was the second? Ostermiller. Okay.
Mike Ostermiller.
Thank you. Any discussion to that motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Beth Holbrook, and then who said yes? Andrew Johnston, you can go next.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It gives me a little heartburn to do this. I'm not sure that I'm ready to go with that because of some of the discussions that have still gone on, and I know I haven't been part of all of that, but I just wanted to articulate that. Thank you.
Okay. Andrew.
I would agree with that, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at a few of these. Appeal authority would move to constitutionality issues potentially, which is a difficult box to open up. And there are damages right now, financial penalties. And while I personally agree minimum base density is a great idea overall for everybody, the question is how do you apply that from the state level down to so many situations that are difficult? I think the point that we've brought up in the parking with the the presentation we had earlier is that it's very nuanced. It's very difficult. That's why they didn't come down with a parking recommendation. Similar thing can be done for this one, I believe. So I think we need a lot more work on these before it goes to legislation. That's made me nervous.
Okay. And Representative White.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the hundreds of hours of work that have gone in over the summer on each of these topics with the team that have been working together on it. With several of these items still having unanswered questions, I have some hesitancy moving these forward with UEOC and even in the upcoming legislative session. Kind of the policy framework, three questions that have been on my mind throughout this process. The question of, will the policy proposal result in more homeownership? Will the proposed policy result in more housing units that are directly affordable to the buyer or the renter? And the third question that's been on my mind is, will the proposed policy result in single detached homes under $450,000 to help first-time home buyers? And as I look at the items here, I think they're very valid ideas for consideration and debate and discussion. I'm just not sure if they're to a point where, in my mind, they'd be ready to present next week to UEOC or in the upcoming legislation. But discussion continue needs to be with these items to be able to see what can come from these to be able to address the supply-demand issue.
Yeah. Representative Briscoe.
Representative Briscoe has a question about the motion. I have been to UEOC meetings in the past in which the CHA has said, these are the things we agree on. This is what we're asking you to take action on. And FYI, by the way, here's some items that we're in discussion and process on that we're not presenting to you as consensus items. So I wouldn't have a problem with these two gentlemen going to UEOC and saying, here's the list of things we're working on that everyone's copacetic with. This is a list of six items that people feel strongly about, and we're trying to make progress. I'm okay with that. I'll vote for that. I will not vote if we're going to present these. I will not vote in favor of putting these six items on as saying, this is policy that CHA supports at this time.
Okay. Thank you. I think that the motion before us is more like your second one.
Okay.
And since I've got the floor for a minute before I call for this vote, I agree. You know, like the CHA gets to decide what the policy recommendations are and not the working group, right? And the working group is designed specifically to have somewhat adversarial parties as part of that discussing and trying to come up with, and they've reached consensus on several projects. I'm a little uncomfortable that the commission would just say, well, both of these groups, they came to consensus on some things and not on others. And if we just simply reject these just because there's not consensus, then what we're doing is just giving veto power to one party or the other. And I think that the commission as a whole ought to, you know, make its decision about what policies we support. And it's very possible that we agree with the subgroup and think that, you know, for whatever reason, that these aren't ready to go forward as policy recommendations. And so that's why we have the motion. So I'll place that motion now unless – okay, who is it? Who? Tom? Tom McDonald.
Hi, I've had the opportunity to be the co-chair of this subgroup, and I think you pretty well worded it well. We have an agreement on a whole lot of good things to Representative White's statement earlier. It took a fair bit of time to get to, and we don't have agreement on this. So if you know that moving forward, then you'll know that some things will go through fairly smoothly and others wouldn't go through quite as smoothly. So.
And Chris, you get one more bite at the apple, and then I'll hear from Wayne Niederhauser.
Just to speak to the motion, I thought you felt like you were about to call for the question, and I wanted to speak to the motion since I made it.
Hang on just a second. You'll get a chance to sum before we go. I'll do Wayne Niederhauser and then come to you.
I just wanted a clarification on the
motion. Yeah. Oh, okay. Go ahead. Okay. Gambrulis, go ahead. You can go ahead and sum on your motion, and then we'll place a vote.
Yeah, I think the intent really was the second, as you were summing, Senator the idea was that we would still advance these concepts to the UEOC, not saying that there is consensus on them, but certainly not keeping them from being discussed at the UEOC or even presenting them. And so I wasn't necessarily trying to make the statement that there was a policy agreement on them, even from the larger CHA. So if I need to amend the motion in that to clarify that I'm happy to
Let me try to state an amended motion here, that what you're suggesting is that we present the consensus items as policy recommendations and present these policy items without consensus as things that are worth further consideration.
Yes, that was the intent of the motion.
And I think that's what Joel said he supported. So we've got something of a substitute motion, and I assume that's still seconded by Mr. Ostermiller. So unless I hear objection, I'm just going to call that a motion and a second. We've had some good discussion on this. So just to restate the motion before I place it, the motion is to present the consensus items as the CHA's policy recommendations and to present these non-consensus items as things that we believe require more discussion and more work before they would be policy recommendations. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say no. All right, I'll declare that motion passes unanimously. And I don't believe that we have any other business before us. And so we have updated our financial requests. We've adopted policy recommendations, and I believe we are now ready for a motion to adjourn, which is made by Representative Briscoe and seconded by Beth Holbrook. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no. That motion passes unanimously, and we are adjourned.